The Hebrew Order of David is one of our community's oldest and most established global outreach organizations. Join Stan Claff for the next hour as he explores the issues facing the men in the community. The HOD Hour is a fundraising initiative for the HOD. Welcome to the HOD Hour with Stan Claff.
Today is 164 days in lockdown. I don't know where this is all going, but tonight we're going to talk about Israel, and that by popular demand is none other than Jonathan Pollen, who, as everybody knows, is an erudite and well-read and well-versed in Israeli information, and we're going to pick his mind about various things that are going on in Israel. It's been a little quiet because I'm not sure if COVID is having an effect on Israel, but anyway, welcome, Jonathan. Let's explore what we're going to talk about.
Hi, Stan. Hi. Hello.
Hi, and thanks for coming on, and thanks for giving us the time. Jonathan, there's been quite a bit of activity going on in Israel. So really, I'd like to unpack a few of the issues that have been happening, and perhaps you can enlighten us as to where it's going, what it means. The first thing is, of course, the deal with the UAE, so United Arab Emirates, which I suppose 10, 15 years ago, nobody would have thought was possible. But here it's happening. Tell us what you know.
So I don't have any particular information beyond that, what anyone is paying attention to the news. I think it's very positive. The inside information I can give you is that I work in a high-tech firm, and we've been working with companies in Dubai and other countries that Dubai or the UAE that don't have, and other countries that don't have diplomatic relations with Israel for 20 years. And today, I'm an engineer and I provide, I do development. And it also involves providing support for the customers. And today I was on a phone call with people from one of the countries that don't have diplomatic relations with Israel. In the past, when we used to do these phone calls, Israel and the people in Israel in whatever country it was would phone into a number saying Holland. And so then there was some kind of pretense that they were not speaking to people in Israel. And I don't really know whether they know that I'm speaking, whether they're speaking to people in Israel. But it's not only the company, but the company I work for also have representatives in these countries. And I'm pretty sure they know.
They talk about normal relations. I mean, that's what's normal today anyway. But normal relations, I presume we're talking about trade, we're talking about cooperation on various levels, and you've just spelled out one of them. And of course, I presume that travel and tourism is a big part of this. Not that there hasn't been travel and tourism, but I suppose this must open some doors.
Based on everything we've heard in the news media, including almost the next day, various ministers from here and from UAE were already in touch with one another. They were making contact, trying to come to agreements and just trying to give that. This is going to be more than a cold peace. And they were talking directly. Previously, you couldn't phone the UAE directly, which might have been one of the reasons why people were phoning into Holland. And by the sounds of it, they want Israelis to come and want people to travel there. The contacts with the UAE started after Oslo. They started Oslo was in 1992, I can't even remember anymore the exact date, but 1992. And immediately after that, from what I've been reported here, Israel sent a representative to be in the UAE, but it was someone with a foreign passport. And a lot of Israelis in the last years have been traveling to Dubai, but on foreign passports. So the contacts were there, but they were low profile. and yeah, it will be open. I think this is an amazing, it's an unbelievable change.
Because is the UAE going to move their embassy to Jerusalem?
No chance I'd have an embassy in Jerusalem.
Not going to build it next to Donald Trump's, one of Donald Trump's hotels, or?
Yeah, Donald Trump hasn't yet invested in Israel.
This is the route he wants to go. Maybe this is the opening.
I'm not sure about that, but I think this is bigger. In practical terms, this is bigger than the recognition of Jerusalem, because it changes the whole dynamic between Israel and the Arab world and a lot of the Muslim countries. That the UAE is opening its doors and opening to full diplomatic relations, economic, travel. To me, it's a game changer. The recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital had some effect. It was maybe rectifying a wrong that the rest of the world, for all kinds of different reasons, didn't want to recognize Jerusalem, even if it's just West Jerusalem as Israel's capital.
Sure.
But in practical terms, every ambassador comes to Jerusalem. America had a consul in Jerusalem. So that was more, it was a visual, it was a bells and whistle, but the contact with the UAE, that's an unbelievable change. Also, surprisingly, I've started looking at the UAE, the economy is enormous for a country that size. It's a bigger economy than the Israeli economy.
Sure.
It's a wealthy country. The strange thing, they've got 1 million citizens and 10 million residents.
Yeah, well, a lot of people work there.
Yes.
I'm
looking forward to the opportunity to travel.
Absolutely. Why not?
Yeah.
Tell me, what about the area, the countries around Israel in close proximity? I mean, that's unlikely that they'll have normal relations, possibly Egypt, but the other countries, I mean, are they likely to open to this extent? Are there other countries besides those that are going to open? I mean, there has been talk.
Well, Israel has a peace agreement and relations with Jordan and with Egypt, but it was always a pretty cold peace, and both those countries economically are basket cases. So from an economic point of view, it doesn't contribute that much to Israel. But Israelis have traveled since 1979 to Sana'a, and they go often there. A lot of Israelis travel to Jordan. It's less so in the last few years, but a lot of people will fly if they're going to the Far East. They will fly from Tel Aviv to Amman and then to the Far East. It's a lot cheaper and it's quicker. A lot of Israelis travel to Morocco, and there's been still in a Moroccan Jewish community, and you can travel on your Israeli passport. It's interesting to see which other countries will follow suit. The surprising one that I'm not sure there's too much economic benefit if Israel does establish relations is Sudan, which was very radical and very anti-Israel.
There's some countries in that region that are never going to normalize relations. I mean, or if they do, it's a long way off. But there must be some countries who might be quite keen to do business with Israel, and it might open other doors for them. I mean, it's surely the peace is much more desirable than having this, you know, continual war that costs money, etc., etc. It's got to be an advantage to everyone involved.
Well, there's talk that Saudi Arabia and Bahrain. That those are the two that are coming up the most. If Saudi Arabia makes establishes diplomatic relations with Israel, it's almost a fantasy to think that would happen. It reminds me, when I left South Africa, I left in 1984, and if someone had told me that in 1994, Nelson Mandela would become president of South Africa, I would have thought they're daydreaming. And from what I've read, even Nelson Mandela in the 1980s never thought he would be president of South Africa. He never thought in his lifetime would be a change. So the idea that Saudi Arabia and Israel have diplomatic relations, that kind of change. Even the UAE, with all the bad news that you hear here, that you're hearing with COVID and the economy and Israel's, basically we've got a failing political system, to suddenly hear the UAE establishing relations was a morale booster. It said there's a light at the end of the tunnel.
Does this play well for Bibi?
I don't think so. I don't think it's going to play that well for. I think for the people who believe in Bibi, it's another element that says only he can be prime minister, but I've never been a Bibi supporter, but I always try to be fair to him. And in this area, he did the right thing. He did the right thing because he claims was peace for peace, but in actual fact, the annexation, even though it was unlikely to go ahead anyway, has now been put on the back burner. And I think most people who are, the majority of Israelis, were not that interested in that annexation, but I think a large number of Israelis understand the importance of having a deal with UAE and the advantages it can bring to Israel.
Does this have an effect on the Palestinian population in some way? Matters it lessen their, is it kind of work against them? Is it not good for them, or is it also equally good for them?
Well the good side that they could say for them is that the annexation stopped. It's on the back burner. It's unlikely to happen. So from their point of view, they can say there's still a chance they'll have a two-state solution or their own state. It's clearly, if you're Palestinian and you look that a country like the UAE is establishing diplomatic relations with Israel and full diplomatic relations without giving anything to the Palestinians, for them it's bad. It feels bad. Just as Israelis or most Israelis would be elated by this, Palestinians would see it as another instance where the world is ignoring them or turning their backs on them.
Right. I'm sure that the Palestinian authorities, whoever they are, must feel kind of in a kind of a betrayal, perhaps.
I'd imagine. The Israeli papers have been reporting that a guy called Mohammed Dahlan. Mohammed Dahlan was the main Fatah guy in Gaza. And when Hamas took over, he fled. He also does not have good relations with Mohammed Abbas. So there have been reports, but who knows? I don't know. It's just something I've read that's been reported here, that he helped to push the UAE to establish the diplomatic relations with Israel. The reality is, In a way, I'm not sure there's a chance of a two-state solution, but if there's anything that will bring the majority of Israelis to feel secure the two-state solution, is establishing relations with Arab countries. That the less Israelis feel threatened, the more likely they are to compromise. The Israelis who won't compromise
for the settlers and a lot on the far right. They condemned the establishment of relations, not because they opposed the establishing of relations, but because they wanted an annexation, and a lot of them weren't happy with the annexation because it wasn't annexing the whole of the West Bank or Judea and Samaria. It was only going to, they were only annex part of it. So for them, they see that as the end of the world, that somehow Israel had an opportunity to annex all the territory, bring it under Israeli sovereignty, and for them, a lot of them see it as a once in a lifetime, or once in who knows what length of time opportunity for Israel to establish sovereignty over those areas. But I think for the majority of Israelis, we're not interested in the annexation. And I'm not sure establishing diplomatic relations with the UAE is going to change the lives of the majority of Israelis, but it will, the economic connection will intensify and grow, and hopefully it will lead to other deals with other countries.
What happens if there's, God forbid, there's another conflict or another war with any of the other countries? Could they count on the UAE as an ally, or would they keep out of it?
Well, the reason this has happened is not because Bibi or Trump or any of the other Israeli politicians, even those established Oslo, are great visionaries. The reason that this happened, the major reason, is Iran. It's created... Yes. Allies between Israel and the more moderate Sunni Arab countries who fear Iran, and that deepened the relations between Israel and these countries.
Is Iran somewhat weakened these days? I mean, it seems as if they're still rattling the sabers, but I don't think they've got any power anymore.
Iran is dangerous. It's like North Korea. No matter how poor it is, they've got nuclear weapons. So Israel, Iran's dangerous. And Hezbollah is dangerous. They're sitting with 130,000 missiles. They can do huge damage to Israel.
Yes, yes.
With all the Iron Dome and all Israel's military power, when you've got 130,000 missiles aimed at you and close to your border and you're a small country, it can do huge damage.
Okay, so moving away from this side of it, what are the Netanyahu, the cases that are against him? Is that seem, you don't hear much, but it is going on.
He had a hearing, and he's meant to have some more hearings. The cases are going on. Yeah, they're going on, and he's doing his best to either manipulate the system or to have more elections or to try appoint people in the kinds of positions that might enable him to escape from justice, or at least from a trial.
Can't he sort of engineer some sort of deal?
Netanyahu doesn't seem to want to go. He wants to stay. He wants to hang on to power. And to me, anyone who still believes in the man after his behavior over the last 6 months, I find it hard to understand how people can still trust him or believe in him or regard him as a serious leader.
If you look at the world, I mean, we've got some very strong leaders. I mean, starting with Donald Trump, then Boris in England, we've got Vladimir in Russia, we've got Netanyahu. I mean, you know, I thought the world was in pretty safe hands.
Netanyahu's not a strong leader.
Netanyahu was a strong leader, but it seems to have lost the faith of the people.
Yeah, Netanyahu is sadly in a moment of, a leader gets tested when they face a crisis. There's a difference between managing, which for most of the time Netanyahu managed, and he's a smart, capable guy, and he did it well, and Israelis were happy, the economy was growing, we had the relative peace, we had a few wars with Gaza, but there was relative stability. But his handling of the COVID crisis and the economic consequences has not been good, and he's kept Israelis in suspense about having new elections. We've already had three elections because of him. We went to the brink on Monday of having an election again on totally false pretenses. There was Netanyahu made a coalition agreement. It started out, if Israel doesn't pass a budget and hadn't passed a budget by Monday night, automatically would have gone to new elections. On Monday night, the law was passed to extend the period till Israel has to pass a budget, another 120 days. And the reason we had a budget crisis when Netanyahu created, after the last election, and created the coalition agreement said that Israel would pass a two-year budget, something that Netanyahu has always wanted, a two-year budget. And then once he got into power and he made the agreement, and once he got into power, he decided he didn't want to pass the two-year budget because that would give him an opportunity to call elections. He wanted a one-year budget. He'd give him an opportunity to call elections before he had to hand over power to Gantz.
So, does he really think he can win an election? Well, he's always thought he could win an election.
I think he does. I think someone who's been in power this long, I think he's lost a little bit of touch with reality. During the COVID crisis, after Israel opened up, after the number of cases went down in May, he passed laws to give himself a million shekel tax break. From 2009 to 2019, he got taxes back. Now, no other Israeli, you can't go back to 2009 and get your taxes back. That can't be done. He did it at a time when we had a million people unemployed, and even though the economy is relatively open, you can go to restaurants here, you can go to the malls are open, shops are open. We've got 850,000 people unemployed, which for Israel is enormous. It's 18%. It went up from very low unemployment. And here the Prime Minister is arranging for himself a million shekel tax break. This is a man who, according to Forbes, is worth $15 million. But even if it's not $15 million, he owns a house in Caesarea, one of the most expensive areas in Israel. He owns a penthouse in Jerusalem, and he has a half share of another apartment. He did a deal with a cousin where he made $4 million. So he's not short of money.
But I mean, Jonathan, $15 million shekels, I mean, that's hard to live on.
$15 million. If you're Prime Minister,
you've got to keep Mrs. Netanyahu in the stars she wants to be accustomed to.
Apparently.
One second. We just want to just repeat. We're talking to Jonathan Pollan, living in Israel, a commentator on what goes on there. And we've been talking about the UAE and the Israeli deal, which seems to be very favorable for everyone. We're now talking about Netanyahu, his chances of staying out of jail, his chances of being re-elected. And I suppose all of this is all mixed up into the same thing. If he can keep doing good and he can keep manipulating the politics there, he stays in power. Is that right?
He's been pretty good at manipulating, but I have many friends who are more right-wing, a lot more right-wing. I work in a company where I live in Jerusalem and work in Jerusalem in a high-tech company. And most of the people are, a lot of people are settlers. I would say the majority are a lot more right-wing than I am. And I think people are getting, I don't know how to put it, they a lot of them think, you know, they don't look at any other politician and say, this person can replace him. But there's a lot of anger.
Frustration.
There's anger in Israel against the political class here. We've got a failed political system. We've got a government that's not functioning. It's dysfunctional. We've had three elections in the last year. The handling of the COVID, initially Israel looked as though it handled it very well because we had a shutdown, and the shutdown seemed to work. And then once the cases went down to less than 20, the country just opened up.
They did it on their own before they were kind of, they got pushed into it rather than by the authority.
The decision to do it was because Israel never established a COVID authority. We never had a COVID authority. We never had, which at least seems to be from South Africa. South Africa, I know, with all the problems and the corruption, but there seemed to be some kind of a, from what I've been reading, some kind of a COVID authority that said, this is how things need to go. This is how you need to open schools. In Israel, you could have had one day you'd get a notification that this could happen, and the next day it got cancelled. And also, it's sad, but a lot of the Israeli cases and a lot of the problems came from three different areas. One, Israel didn't shut down travel to America. So a lot of people who flew at the beginning of the COVID crisis, and they didn't do it because of fear of Trump. So a lot of people came in from America. They didn't go into isolation. The second is the Haredi population ignored a lot of the rules. The health minister was from the Haredi community, and he got COVID. And subsequently, they came out with his diaries. He's no more the health minister since we had the new government with. And it turns out most of the meetings where they were discussing the COVID, he wasn't even there. He wasn't participating. He ignored the rules and the regulations. And sadly, not only him, during the height of the, when we were in complete isolation during Pesach, Israelis were told to stay at home. You couldn't, there was police roadblocks. You weren't supposed to move 100 meters from your home. And the Prime Minister had put out a picture that he was having the Seder with his son who doesn't live with him. His one son does and the other one doesn't. And the President did the same thing. And the Health Minister, whose ministry was putting out these tough regulations, was carrying on his normal life. And at the moment, again, a lot of the cases are coming from the Arab community and from the Haredi community. But for political reasons, instead of Israel is not putting, it doesn't, it's trying to avoid putting a seger, I'm using the Hebrew word, but where everyone has to stay at home, on the whole country, but there's certain hotspots, and for all political reasons, those hotspots are not being shut down.
Yeah.
So, if the economic handling the stories you hear of people who independent businessmen, small people who established small businesses, getting wiped out. Because the government took a long time to come up with, they claimed they had the money, but it took a long time. It was very hard for people to get money. The way the government did was that they would, you'd have to go to the bank. They were initially, this is the way they did it. The government would guarantee 85% of a loan and 15% would come from the bank. And the banks said, they're not going to give loans to companies that they don't think they can pay it back.
Of course not.
Even if it's 15%.
That's been the problem. That's the problem, is the banks will help you. Even here, the banks will offer you help. They'll give you some sort of leeway to take loans or to consolidate your debt or do what, but you're going to pay interest on it and you're going to pay all that money back. Certainly not, and they're also looking at you and turning you upside down to see what falls out of your pocket.
Yeah.
So the banks are no help in that regard.
The sad thing also, there was I don't know if people have heard of the Fox chain, which is they own the retail clothes.
Yes, yes.
So during the height of COVID, they got from the government tens of millions of shekels, because they claimed they needed it. They also, all their stores in malls, they stopped paying the rent. The week after they got the money, they paid out dividends of about 40 or 50 million shekels. And they got from the government about 60 or 70 million shekels. This week it was reported that Fox made more money in the last 3 months this year than they made last year. So obviously it did very well online. But they didn't pay their rent to the mall, and they took money from the government, and they wanted to get money from the government. In the end, I think they had to give that money back. But there were other ways there's other money that they're getting, because Israel gave an incentive to companies, if you rehire people that you hadn't fired, they put them on, I don't know if you've got a similar concept in South Africa, they have unpaid leave. I don't know if there's a legal concept like that in South Africa.
They've taken it on some, look, here they're supposed to be helped by the Unemployment Insurance Fund, which is the UIF. But to get the money out of them, I mean, some people have been paid. There's massive corruption there. And this week they announced again that they've stopped the payouts because there's corruption. Look, in South Africa, you can't knock corruption because probably the only thing that's keeping the economy going. But in general, look, people have gone back to work, and yeah, you know, they have been assisted. The Jewish community has been amazing in the way that they've helped people. You could, Rambam here, where you can get a 15,000 rand loan almost overnight with no surety and nothing. You have to pay it back over a year. There are bigger funds and bigger organizations where they'll help you. And certainly if you need money, you can get it in the Jewish community. From the point of view of the general public, they've gone back to work because it's desperation. And one of the things which was holding back some of the industries was, first of all, the smoking. Cigarettes weren't available. And the second thing was alcohol. So restaurants who relied mainly on the alcohol for their profit, you know, they can turn over the food, but people want to drink. And so that is where the profit lies. And so they've only brought that back with limitation up to 10 o'clock, et cetera, et cetera. But it has released, and a lot of people are going back. So from the economy, I can understand in any economy or any country, you would have to be foolish to ignore the economics of the place, because if you can't earn, a country can't sustain helping people forever. I mean, here 15 or 16,000 or 17,000, not sure the exact figure, but are on some sort of assistance from the government, and they've upped that amount by 300 or 400 rand to assist people in some instances, and they've given others and they doled out money to people, and you go to the banks, they're doling it out. And so, you know, to sustain that out of a country of 50 million is something like a third. Besides that, unemployment is a massive problem. So I can understand, you know, in any society, but people have been pretty cautious here. I think from all points of view, we've done mostly the right thing. I think there's some issues. I think there's issues with coming back to schools, and the unfortunately, the unions here seem to hold sway, and but now we seem to be going back to school, particularly the matrix and such. Yeah. You know, it's all working, but I wouldn't say that it's everything's hunky-dory, but people are still getting it. People are dying. I mean, in the homes, there's issues with the homes and all that. But in the main, I think we have done the right thing. You're correct. I don't know why Israel turned bad from a good situation. It just doesn't make sense.
I tell you, in part, it's the nature of who Israelis are. Even I've got a strong South African accent after being here all these years. I want to say we. How do Israelis work best? In a crisis. When you have a crisis and you have to deal with it. Then people come up with all kinds of solutions and can get things done. And in truth, in the work I do, that's mainly what I'm doing in the high tech area. There's a crisis. We wrote some software. It's not working and the customer needs it fixed and it's urgent. And then who do they turn to very often? The Israelis. We come up with quick ways to fix things. But when you've got a broken political system and a prime minister who, despite everything, and no matter what you say about him, what you believe about him, but he's got three serious cases, he's got three serious charges against him, potentially others down the line, in regards to the submarine. So he needs to appoint the right people that they don't investigate this. And you have a crisis like COVID and the economic crisis. And also a man who, for all those who admire him, you've got to look that anyone who's threatened his power, he's removed. Around him in the Likud party, the people that surround him are yes men or other people who follow his every word. What he says, they will follow and do what he does. He's a man who wants to be president, and we don't have a presidential system. We have a system where the executive and the parliament should be separated but are not separated and are not functioning. Israel hasn't passed the budget since last year. They just have not passed the budget. The way the budget is, they take the budget from that was last passed, and they divide it up into monthly sections, and all the departments, ministries, more or less keep the same amount of money. They've passed additional laws to give money in because of COVID. But an actual budget that's planned, it didn't happen, and it's not happening.
But is it doable?
We're going to be in what we just had. Maybe people in South Africa didn't feel it, but on till Monday night when they passed when in the last moment Netanyahu said, "Okay, I will support the law to extend for another 120 days that we can pass the budget." So it keeps, I can think of a Yiddish word, keeps everyone on spielkes here. You're sitting, are we going to have another government? Are we going to have another elections? It's outrageous. It's an outrageous what's happening here. It's so disappointing. I understand ideological differences. And I understand politicians, you know, they need to do certain things, and sometimes politicians don't always tell the truth. But in a time like this, to be playing political games is incomprehensible to me. Incomprehensible.
But is it possible in these uncertain times to actually do a budget, or you just take a stab in the dark and
have
to work
out? So when the coalition agreement was made with Blue and White, the part of the coalition agreement was there'd be a budget for 2 years. That would mean that Gantz, if nothing else brought the government down, Gantz would have become prime minister in 18 months. Maybe Netanyahu would have found another reason, but that's his easiest reason. So the finance minister announced maybe a week or two ago that he had told the finance ministry from the beginning to only prepare a one-year budget. So he had no intention of ever having prepared a two-year budget.
Then, so he just went off at his own, on his own tangent.
Well, that's what Netanyahu was telling him. Then Netanyahu said, okay, we'll pass the law to extend the date that we can to have the budget by 100 or 120 days. But he wants in that law an exit strategy. That at any time during, over different, I don't know, 2 weeks or 4 weeks, he can decide that we're not passing the budget and we can go to an election. What we've done now is, all he's done, it's given him another exit point. In another 120 days, unless something dramatic happens, we're going to be in a crisis. And what a lot of the commentators saying, it had nothing to do with the budget. It all has to do, we don't have a police chief, and we don't have we have an attorney general, and we have an attorney general, and someone reports to him, the person who actually decides to prosecute. I don't know what the name would be in English.
Attorney general.
He's a mixture of attorney general, and when America would be attorney general, but we also have someone else who's
a public prosecutor.
Yes, basically. And the part of the coalition was that Netanyahu couldn't just choose these people.
And he that's supposed to be the separation of powers in any government is supposed to have that separation of power.
Yes, and he needs to choose these people.
He needs to control both.
Yeah, he wants to choose people who will fit
in with his
needs. Now, he might genuinely believe he's innocent, and maybe he's innocent maybe he shouldn't have been charged. The claim from Netanyahu and a claim from the right for a long time has been against the High Court of Justice. The High Court of Justice, 25 years ago, we never had a constitution, so they interpreted that the individual rights need to get, say, equal weight with the national rights. Whereas a lot of them, the people on the right don't want the Supreme Court also decided the Supreme Court seen that it had the right to look at any law passed by the Knesset and decide it wasn't legal for what the justices decided are legitimate reasons. Many on the right objected to that because they wanted, if they had the majority, that the Knesset could pass any law if it had over 61 or above, because we've got 120 members, that law would become law. There's virtually no democratic country. It would remove the separation of power, that you have justice, executive, and parliament. Already, we don't really have any real difference between the parliament and the executive. When the coalition, if there's a majority and they decide on something, not in the current government, but in previous governments, no one goes against the coalition. The members of the Knesset take their orders from the executive. So we wouldn't have, so the aim was to remove that the Supreme Court wouldn't have any influences on this also. A lot of the people because a lot of them see the idea of individual rights contradicts the idea of Israel being a Jewish state, and they want to give the Jews as a majority more rights in the national interest. And that's problematic. If anyone tried to pass the same kind of laws in Germany, where Germany said today, you have to be German and you'll get more rights than if you're a even if you're a citizen, but say you're an Israeli who went to live there in Germany and you became a German citizen, that would give Germans more rights than other citizens. And that's problematic, especially as Jews, we were the majority here anyway. The country's Jewish character is not going to change.
Isn't it rather inconceivable that people who rely on a Torah as the and all the rules and everything around it and have discussions around, everything revolves around the laws and the mitzvot and everything around it. They can't put together a country which is based on with a proper constitution and everything in place. So, is it because of that that they can't get it together?
It's exactly because of that. Israel never established a constitution because even though in the 1948 Israel, the Haredim were a small percentage of the population, there were other religious Jews. Israel has become increasingly religious. The religious population has grown gradually. For a lot of the religious population, the idea that you'd have a constitution and somehow that constitution would be above the Torah.
That's not going to play well with, I think most Jews would probably feel that.
The reality is Israel was never established as a Jewish religious country. Even when people call Israel as the Jewish, what they mean is it's the national home of for Jews. It wasn't meant to be. There was always this contradiction between democracy and how Jewish it could be. I once heard here in a professor talking about it. And he said, Israel can be as Jewish as, I'm trying to think exactly how he said it. It can't be we don't want to put aside everything to do with Jewish, and anyone who comes to Israel or in Jerusalem or if you're in a religious area, the holidays, the character of the country is very clearly Jewish. But you can't have be more Jewish reduce the democracy.
You know why the rest of the world, why there's anti-Semites, because we can't even make up our own minds.
Well, I think if you go back to the majority of the original founders were not religious men. You go to Herzl. Herzl came from it. He had very little awareness of his Judaism till the Dreyfus trial, and he wanted to establish a Vienna in Israel. So he was very secular, and Israel started out as more secular than it
Herzl's. Herzl's some of Herzl's children. I don't know which married out of the faith anyway.
They actually all died young, and. They weren't very happy.
Yeah.
Every Jew at some stage converts or leaves Judaism at some point his family was deeply religious, depending how far back you go.
Yes. But I mean, Israel, when it was formed, they formed in Israel, I decided that the language should be Hebrew, so obviously that's a factor, because I mean that must have been an issue at some point.
The original Zionists were very strong on re-establishing Hebrew. In fact, a lot of them were anti-Yiddish.
Yes.
And the idea in some ways that the right has of putting Jewish nationalism above individual rights, or nationalism above individual. In some ways, that was true of the left when they established Israel. Israel made a lot of decisions where it took the national interest when the country was established more than than individual human rights. There's stories about people coming off the boats and 6 hours later they're fighting in Jerusalem.
We've come to be getting, I'm getting messages from the producers to say we need to wrap up. Jonathan Pollan talking to us from Jerusalem. I mean, I could have had conducted this discussion for much longer. I think it was fascinating. I can't wait to see what happens down the road. And Jonathan definitely will be invited back, as I said, by popular demand. You have a way of putting things which I think people who don't know much about Israel, even if they do, there was a show the other night on, I'm sure, and they had a lady from Stand With Us, and she was talking from that we need education, and I think this falls into the place of education. We need to know what's going on. So the position as it is at the moment, there's some good news, there's some bad news, but that's always the case. Israel, it's a fascinating place. And Jonathan, thanks again for coming on, and thanks to everybody for listening. This is the Hebrew Order of David, the HID Hour, and I'm sure we'll talk again.